This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Today is the last day on the job for the courts reporter for the Bloomington Pantograph newspaper. Edith Brady Lunny is retiring and sounding an alarm at the decline of community-based journalism across the nation.
People need to really understand that when they lose their local media, they're losing their local watchdogs. And there won't be anybody left to keep an eye on the local city, county governments, even their justice system.
GLT's Ryan Denham talks with Edith Brady Lunny about the institutions needed to keep democracy strong. Plus, Laura Kennedy deconstructs our ideas of painting and sculpture with locally sourced recycled items. She talks about a new exhibit with Katie Bell, the artist, and Bloomington's Parks and Rec director talks improvement projects. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The McLean County Law and Justice Center is an important place where our community hashes out the way we treat each other and how the system treats all of us. But the courthouse is also an intimidating place with strict rules, locked doors, and hard-to-access files. We need a guide, and for the last 12 years, we have had Edith Brady Lunny. She is the courts reporter at the Pantograph. She is retiring today. GLT's Ryan Denham talked to Brady Lunny about her career and how her passion for mental health issues began with her own community work in Clinton in DeWitt County.
The two issues intersected in McLean County about 2010 or 11, I think. The former sheriff, Mike Emery, came to me and said, "You need to come and see my booking area. It's a mess." It's not very often that a county sheriff will invite you over to see something that's not good about their facility. So I went, and he gave us full access to the booking area and showed us what was going on there. And in fact, it was the mental health unit for McLean County in terms of holding the most seriously mentally ill for long periods of time. So we started covering that at the Pantograph. Paul Swike also joined me in doing a lot of that coverage, and David Praber photographed these stories all along the way. And then we put together in 2014 an hour-long documentary that is still available on YouTube called Shortchanged, Unjailing the Mentally Ill. And we had a packed house at the Normal Theater. We had 400 or 500 people come to watch that documentary, and that told the story not only of what was going on at the jail, but how the McLean County Board took on the issue after it was shown to them by the sheriff and people in the criminal justice.
Well, over the last 9 years, since Sheriff Emery showed you his mess in his mental health unit, his makeshift mental health unit, how different is the county's approach to mental health today versus the day you got that phone call?
Since we got the phone call and started our long, extended, I wouldn't even call it a series. It was just ongoing coverage of the county's initiative to improve mental health. And today, McLean County government essentially has a mental health department, I would call it. They have a coordinator who works to keep all of the elements of their initiative going. And there is a housing program that's just started. The county is opening a triage center that will be 24-hour assistance where people can walk in off the street. The county helps support the Crisis Stabilization Center at Chestnut Health Systems. And along the way, they have also, kind of in the background, nudged all of the agencies that provide care to better collaborate so that people are more often staying out of the emergency rooms, out of jail. The county also recently opened the jail with a state-of-the-art mental health unit. There's not another county in Illinois. There's not another county sheriff's department in Illinois that is doing what McLean County is doing to not only support mental health change, but making mental health change.
All right, let's pivot a little bit. I want to kind of get a sense of individual cases that have kind of stuck with you, things that you've covered over the last 12 years as a courts and justice correspondent for the Pantograph. What have been some of your, I don't want to use the word favorite cases to cover, but cases that just had the most interesting combination of kind of puzzle pieces within it?
I think some of the post-conviction cases have been really interesting. I followed Alan Beeman's case since I came here in 2007. And at that point, Alan Beeman was just on the cusp of his successful petition to be exonerated. So with the post-conviction cases, they offer a whole host of issues. There's an examination of how the police did their job to convict someone and the long effort that goes into trying to get back into court, have the case looked at. In his case, he's been to the Supreme Court multiple times, and he's waiting now to find out if he's going to have a trial in civil court against the officers. So there's just a whole host of issues in post-conviction cases. I also like to follow what happens with some of the younger offenders to see how they are able to overcome their challenges. I recently did a story looking back at three young men who I had covered several years ago. And at the time I covered them initially, they were illustrative of the success the community and the criminal justice system was having in trying to put people back on the right track before they really got into trouble. And one of them has since been killed in a shooting. And one of them will find out in about a week whether or not he'll be going back to prison at 26 for the fourth time, or whether the county will give him a chance to be in community-based care.
And a lot of the times you're following cases over a period of years, and I'm sure you've struck up relationships with criminal defendants or mm-hmm. people who went to prison or were on trial and were acquitted. Who are some of the characters that you've encountered that mm-hmm. that have stuck with you, the people?
Yeah, it's not uncommon for me to be walking around downtown and have somebody just come up and shake hands with me or yell at me across the street, and it will be somebody that I've known for years. I think of Randy Reeser. He was in our documentary, and he's a very memorable character in that documentary because he had several cats. And there's a really touching moment in there where he's trying to pull a cat along on a leash in the documentary. And matter of fact, he still has that cat. And when I see him, he always yells at me and waves and will tell me that he hopes we'll come back and take some more pictures of Blackie because, you know, Blackie's become a bit of a celebrity. People, you know, they don't forget you when you follow them for a long period of time. You really kind of develop a connection with them.
Well, they don't forget you. And I guess what about the negative part of that? Were you ever afraid of that someone was going to threaten you or come after you for writing a story about, I mean, these are some of the worst moments in a person's life that you're writing about in a lot of cases.
Right. And I think it just kind of goes along with the job that everybody's not going to be happy. And in this day and age, I mean, with what we know, the threats that are made against reporters, and some of those threats are carried out, there's been violence, you know, across the country against journalists. So I do take those seriously. And if I get something that sounds threatening in an email or something, I have passed it on to the authorities so that they're aware and they can help maybe gauge whether it's the seriousness of the threat. But a lot of times people will call me and they will be really upset about how something was written. And you can talk to a lot of people and try to explain how and why a story was written, and that kind of, you know, you can take some of the heat out of the complaint. With some people, you're never going to take the heat out. And then, you know, you just have to know how to hang up the phone and end that conversation.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm in studio with Edith Brady Lunny, the courts reporter at the Pantograph. She's retiring Friday. So, Edith, you are a quote-unquote regular person. You're not a lawyer, not a judge, you're not a bailiff, but you see what all those people see in the courtroom. So what do you think are some of the biggest, like, misperceptions that the general public has about how the justice system works or doesn't work?
I think people don't understand how slow the process is a lot of the time. They don't understand why, like with the Kirk Zimmerman case, took 4 years for that to come to a trial. So I think it's difficult for people to see that once a person is arraigned, I mean, they can come back to court on a monthly basis for years before the motions are heard and everything is ready for trial. I think sometimes they don't understand why some information can be used in a case, why some information is excluded in a case. And those kinds of decisions by judges are made every day, and that really frames how a case is put together. But you really have to sit in the courtroom, I think, for as many hours and days as I have with a case in order to understand that process.
So a big thing that's happening now and something that will impact how the public views the courts is the cameras in the courtroom. This started as a pilot project in 2012 from the Illinois Supreme Court. It's now statewide, a permanent program that gives extended media access to cases that come through. So you are the media coordinator for this area, McLean County and adjacent counties. So you help coordinate TV crews and radio people like me when we come in and are looking for access in a courtroom. So 7 years later, after the pilot version of this started, how do you think that's going, and what do you think it's accomplished?
I think in McLean County and in the 11th Judicial Circuit, which is our five surrounding counties, I think we've been a model for a lot of circuits. I talked to other media coordinators across the state, and there are some places where they haven't really done anything with the extended media program because there hasn't been good coordination, frankly, with the judges and the media. A lot of judges are hesitant to participate in it for a variety of reasons. But here, from the very beginning, we had good cooperation with former chief judges Elizabeth Robb and Kevin Fitzgerald, and now with Chief Judge Mark Fellheimer, have all been really supportive of it. And that has helped us with what's gone on in the courtroom. We've been able to do well over probably 30 to 40 cases we have done where we've had cameras in the courtroom. And that is makes a huge difference for the public because we've been able to show them as well as tell them what happens. When you can film someone's testimony and show that to the public, no matter how good a writer you are, there's nothing like seeing the testimony, seeing photographs of the people as they're testifying to really shine a light of transparency on how the court system operates.
Well, you've worked in local media at many different levels. I mean, you ran a weekly newspaper in Clinton and DeWitt County, where you're from. You've worked in California and Michigan, and obviously at the daily newspaper here in Bloomington, the Pantograph. What is your read at this point in your career on the state of local news in this country and in this part of Illinois?
Like a lot of journalists, I'm really concerned about it. I think we've seen the loss of about 65% of our jobs in the last few years in the news media in this country. And there's a variety of reasons for that. The advertising dollars are now going to the big social media giants instead of to the local radio stations and TV stations and the newspapers. And the problem with that is that as their budgets shrink at these local news outlets, the public is also losing its connection to the news media. And as people need to really understand that when they lose their local media, they're losing their local watchdogs. And there won't be anybody left to keep an eye on the local city, county governments, to everything really, and even their justice system. And when they lose that, they're not only uninformed, there also can be problems that are ongoing and could be costly and, result in injustice and misappropriation of all kinds of things, and the public will not be aware of it.
What do we do about it?
I think people need to be willing to support local journalism. And if that means that they have to change the way that they get their news as the news outlets change the way they're delivering it, if that means they have to pay a bit more in order to keep local journalism in their community, I think it has to be viewed as a necessity.
That's Edith Brady Lenny, the courts reporter at the Pantograph. She's retiring Friday, although I'm sure we'll be seeing her byline as a freelancer in the years to come. Edith, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Ryan Denham.
Brady Lenny will be featured on an episode of NBC's Dateline that airs Monday about the Kirk Zimmerman murder trial.
Support for GLT comes from Bloomington Public Library, where books are just the beginning. Friday, June 21st at 11 a.m., Hocus Pocus Pint-Sized Polkas, a fluid, high-energy live musical performance which incorporates magic, comedy, and education, will entertain families in the library's community room. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a new art exhibit. Laura Kennedy has more on art objects created from found material. Bloomington is working to implement elements of parts of the city's new Parks and Recreation Master Plan. The city adopted the plan in January after it paid a consultant $115,000 to determine how the city can maximize its indoor and outdoor attractions. A cornerstone piece of that plan calls for converting the aging O'Neill Pool into an aquatic center. That's a project that could cost $10 million. Bloomington Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Arts Director Jay Tetzloff tells GLT's Eric Stock, it remains to be seen how much of the master plan, including the pool replacement, will get done.
A lot of it's going to come down to money or resources in general. Some of the things we want to do that don't cost money other than staff time is to go through and evaluate all of our parks. How can we improve our parks? How can we add more amenities for our citizens? And some may be as simple as pollinator gardens, maximizing the space that we have for those kind of things. But, going to O'Neill, it's a pool that, it's a aluminum pool. Those should last 20, 25 years, and I think we just opened our 45th. So we're running out of gum, we're running out of duct tape, and I think my guys do a great job of keeping that functional considering the age of it. Will it be an aquatic center? That's still something we're working on. I meet with city manager periodically, and that's on the topic. And I know he wants to build something new. Because eventually my guys are going to call me and say, it's done. I can't open it again for another year.
And what happens if that closes and there's no replacement?
Well, it would be a loss for that part of the neighborhood, that's for sure. We still have Holiday, but, that's a big gap. That's a lot of kids we're not teaching how to swim. That's the biggest thing. I remember Bobby Hrakovich, who was an interim parks director before me, and she lost an uncle because he drowned. So to me, teaching kids to swim is our job. That's what we should be thriving for. And if we lose a whole pool, then that's a whole that's a pretty good section that does not learn how to swim that year.
The state did pass a capital bill about a week ago that includes money for infrastructure and various projects across the state. And from what I understand, the city is making a new aquatic center a priority to get some funding for this. What kind of conversations have you been involved in on that front? And does that give you any optimism that there could be state dollars to help for this?
I'm always optimistic when it comes to grant funding, foundations, state funding, whatever it is. I look for that kind of stuff every day for all of our different divisions. We've written some things for the city manager to, I think he's passed it on to our different representatives and senators and our lobbyists to let them know of the need that we have here in our community. Tim Gleason and I speak regularly about the issue. It is part of our conversations. It's just how do we fund it? That's where we get down to.
If the state doesn't come through with at least some funding, does this happen in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years? Can it happen with the majority of local dollars?
I think that's a better question for our city manager. I think I'll lay off of that one. Because it really is above me in terms of when and how. Once I hear it's a go, then we jump in and we try to build the best aquatic center we can.
Well, each of the incoming city council members have said they see a new aquatic center as a key priority for them. Of course, they do inherit a budget that they have to follow. Anything that you can do to help move the ball closer to the goal line on this for them?
I think my job right now is to give them all the information when they ask for it, especially having four new aldermen, and I've met with most of them. Here's the information. Here's the situation we're in. We're doing our best to keep it up and going, and we'll do that until funding becomes available for the replacement, whatever that is.
Well, and sometimes parks can be a tough sell for the public. They focus much of their attention on fixing potholes, police, public safety, those kinds of things. And parks are sometimes thought as a luxury. How do you make the case for devoting tax dollars for these kind of projects and the overall good that they can do for a community?
One you mentioned was police. I think it's hard for a police chief, and we're going to have a new one here in the future, to say that having no pool would be a good thing for his department. So I definitely believe that having the kids something to do and keeping them busy is always a positive, no matter what neighborhood they're in. That's always a positive. I think this can be an economic driver, being close to the interstate. If they don't eat the aquatic center, they might eat on market. That's increasing sales tax. I think it's an opportunity to revitalize that part of Bloomington. So, yes, some people say, oh, it's just a pool. I think there's more to it. I think the police side, I think the economic impact, I think revitalizing the neighborhood. And I talked about, teaching kids how to swim. That's one of our priorities. I feel that's the only reason. I shouldn't say that. It's a big reason we have pools to teach kids how to swim. And adults. We have adults that don't know how to swim that we teach.
That is Bloomington Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Arts Director Jay Tetzloff with GLT's Eric Stock. The city is seeking more than just funds for a new aquatic center from the state's new $45 billion capital bill. It's also asking for millions of dollars for economic development, a new city emergency operations center, and the final leg of the Hamilton Road extension.
As headlines accelerate and media proliferate, how we make sense of the world is changing. What's real, what's not. This station works hard to cover the news every day, but some stories shake our worldview so much we just can't hear them. On the Media shows you how. Listen for On the Media Sunday morning at 9 on GLT. News and ideas.
Support for GLT comes from SmartVet, the only mobile veterinary practice serving the Bloomington Normal area. Your pet's healthcare experience is simplified when the vet comes to you. Details at thesmartvet.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The History Makers Gala Banquet is next week for the McLean County Museum of History. We'll profile some of the contributors who make up this year's inductee class of History Makers in just a few minutes. A new site-specific show at the University Galleries deconstructs our ideas of painting and sculpture with locally sourced recycled items that become dynamic installations unique to University Galleries. GLT's arts correspondent Laura Kennedy talks with Katie Bell, whose artistic impulses were formed by her upbringing in a vintage home in a constant state of rehab.
Artist Katie Bell has a background in painting, but she doesn't limit her creative vision to just a canvas. Her latest exhibition, Standing Arrangement, currently up at the University Galleries, reveals her works touch on multiple categories. Bell says she hopes to surprise viewers with her visual landscapes that she constructs from a wide variety of materials. The exhibition's curator is Jessica Bingham. This is her first curated show at the galleries, and she was determined to feature Katie Bell, not only because of the artist's aesthetic, but because Bell's process was so intriguing.
Being site-specific, responding to the city that she's in, finding materials, working with people in the community, and putting together an exhibition that doesn't require just being in the studio and figuring that out, but being on site, responding to our space, which is phenomenal. So I thought she would be perfect for this, for my first show.
And Katie, you have a unique background that lets you work with all these different moving parts before they're finally put together. Your family actually lived in an old Victorian, and that helped to maybe get the art going?
From a really early age, I was around construction sites. My dad is in construction, and then my mom picks paint colors for people's homes. And just in addition to their own careers, it was kind of their lifelong project to restore this old Victorian home. It's just been this kind of lifelong project of constantly renovating and restoring the house. We started just in the upstairs apartment of the house and then eventually kind of moved into the full house. So it was always kind of, to me, kind of thinking about things as rooms. Oh, don't go in that room. That one's totally dusty. This one is okay to go into. And thinking about how spaces can kind of unfold in that way and how walls create space and kind of how rooms can transform a space. Yeah.
Well, you grew up amongst construction, but in a way you're deconstructing what we consider a painting to be.
Yeah, definitely. My background really kind of in art was through painting and was really kind of making paintings of interior home spaces. I was really always interested in material, wallpapers, carpets, different textures. And I started building still lifes to paint from, so really elaborate, make my own wallpaper, bring in a couch from Goodwill, and then kind of start to look at that space and make a painting of it. And I got more and more invested in what was physically in the room than the kind of illusion I was creating on canvas. And so the couch, all of a sudden, I thought, well, what if I cut it in half? That what would my painting look like? And I got less and less interested in making the painting and more interested in just manipulating the kind of physical material in the space.
Jessica, Katie, in each community where she has a show, goes out scavenging creatively, looking for materials to use. Have you guys been scavenging in Bloomington Normal?
We have, yes. Well, Katie started actually last week in Rockford, visiting different spaces where she grew up and spaces that maybe made an impact in her career so far. And then she arrived yesterday here in Bloomington Normal, and we instantly unpacked her van and then started looking around the area. We've gotten a few different tours with some creative people in the area who are willing to work with us and show us their spaces, these intimate, their homes, spaces that they're working on, construction sites. So it was maybe 4 or 5 hours just looking through objects and bringing them back and then playing around with what we had here on site already, looking at colors, shapes, scale and sizes of things, and then how will that look in the space. So she's already been out this morning to hardware stores picking up extra materials, and we're going to go out again as soon as we're done here and start looking for some more objects. So,
Katie, tell me about some of the objects that you've picked up both here and in Rockford for this show.
Yeah, so far I was really kind of inspired by the gallery space kind of having this kind of interesting angular ceiling, almost like a wedge shape. There were certain objects that I had the gallery staff build ahead of time, and then everything's kind of been unfolding from there. So far I've kind of found a few different columns, so these kind of architectural objects. There's scraps of drywall, scraps of laminate countertops, aluminum that I think goes on a roof, different small kind of concrete objects. We're kind of in the space right now, kind of surrounded by them, and how I start to really think about this is laying the materials out like you would a painting palette, like what are the colors that I'm about to work with? What are their forms? So just kind of like making a painting, like maybe you'd start to mix colors. I'm kind of laying things out almost like a blown up palette and kind of looking down bird's eye view and figuring out where are these things going to go? How are they going to kind of connect to each other? And then what do we need?
Tell me about what you want to express with your creations. Is it just a general mood? Is it a specific idea?
I really kind of come from an interest in abstract painting and how color and shapes can kind of transform a space and how that can kind of connect a viewer to this abstract landscape. So for me, I'm always interested in, I'm getting these things from all these different places that have a really deep history. And so these objects kind of bring this history with them. And I'm thinking about how I can kind of transform them into something that becomes more part of my world, but obviously this history comes with them. And so I'm hoping that the viewer in this show, it's this kind of abstract landscape that they're walking through, almost kind of like surveying damage after this unusual storm, but it's a storm in a painting language, not a storm maybe in meteorological sense. It's this kind of abstracted explosion of sorts, yeah.
I love all these various parts in the gallery here. Are you looking for a sense of theatricality when you create?
Definitely. I've always been interested in the idea of a stage space. It's a place for an event to happen, and kind of on this theatrical grand scale. And in a lot of ways, I think about galleries in that way. They're stages for things to happen, and especially the way I work, because I'm not making finished objects in the studio and then just presenting them in the gallery. The gallery is really like where the event unfolds. And so I think that theatricality comes from that spontaneity of responding to this space and being in the space myself physically as an artist and being here for the week and creating something that then, of course, when I leave, it's just this kind of standing arrangement that's left. But for the moment I'm here, it does border on this kind of performative task that I'm making the show.
That's artist Katie Bell and curator Jessica Bingham. Bell's exhibition, Standing Arrangement, is up through August 4th at University Galleries in Normal. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear bonus audio about Katie Bell's enthusiasm for art on social media and more at our website, wglt.org. More and more people are starting their day with GLT's new morning podcast, The Leadoff. Learn more at wglt.org/leadoff. The Leadoff is Bloomington Normal's first daily podcast. We deliver you our biggest story of the day, plus headlines and a preview of evening meetings and other calendar entries. GLT's The Leadoff is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe at wglt.org/leadoff. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A man who fought racial injustice with lessons he learned from the segregated South, a nurse who traveled the globe to heal not just bodies but hearts and minds, a Bloomington Normal power couple who work inside and outside government, all being honored for their decades of dedication to make life better in McLean County and beyond. GLT's Eric Stock introduces us to this year's McLean County History Makers.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a couple who has done more for Bloomington Normal than Rich and Judy Buchanan. He is a mayor, liquor commissioner, and longtime public servant. She is a teacher, advocate, and caregiver. Rich Buchanan served 6 years on the Bloomington City Council, close to 4 decades on the City Liquor Commission, and later on the McLean County Board. But he figures the crown jewel of his political career was his 2 terms as Bloomington mayor from 1977 to 1985.
But I just loved being mayor. I think I was well received. People didn't beat up on me too much.
If there was tension at the time, it was between Bloomington and Normal, two fast-growing cities that at the time had competing interests.
There was a lot of competition, see who could give away the most inducements to entice a good industry, a good business.
Buchanan believes his friendship with then-Normal Mayor Richard Godfrey helped thaw the ice and see how working together was better for both.
This is one community. And don't go trying to torpedo if the town of Normal lands a great employer. Join them, because the Bloomingtonians are going to be working there, too.
Another lengthy contribution is Rich Buchanan's work on the city's liquor commission.
I loved going in the bars. I'd come home at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning after watching the bars close.
Oh, but he was a teetotaler.
You don't have to drink to enjoy things.
Buchanan says he visited every liquor establishment in the city to get to know the owners and make sure they were playing by the rules. He wanted to build trust.
And it showed off, and I think I left a legacy. Be open and straightforward with the people that you're impacting as far as the license holders.
Buchanan says he saw enough about the tavern biz to realize he'd never want to own a bar. He says only twice did he ever have an owner's license revoked. Now in retirement, Buchanan says what he misses most is campaigning. That's why, after being out of elected office for years, he ran for McLean County Board.
If you have Judy Buchanan as your campaign manager, you're going to win.
Judy Buchanan ran many more political campaigns than just those for her husband. She says she learned something from every campaign she ran, win or lose.
I might say tongue-in-cheek, I didn't usually lose, which was good. But I give the credit to the candidate. They're the one that's putting themselves out there.
Those who benefited from Judy Buchanan's campaign expertise included Governor Jim Thompson, Congressman Tom Ewing, Dan Rutherford when he was a state senator and state treasurer, and President George H.W. Bush, whom she introduced when he campaigned in Bloomington Normal. Judy Buchanan got a taste for politics early in life, growing up on the south side of Chicago, where her father worked for the city and became friends with Mayor Richard J. Daley. In those years, Judy says she also developed her passion to help others. In high school, she read a book called The Snake Pit, which depicted deplorable conditions at a mental institution.
I remember speaking with my dad about how horrible that was, and that these are people, they're sick, they're not weird, they're not criminals, they're not dangerous, they're sick. And that began a lifelong, to this day, sense of advocacy for people, particularly who have behavioral health issues.
Buchanan says that area of service became especially challenging when the state began closing mental hospitals with a promise to pay for local programs to reintegrate people with mental illness into the community.
However, the money, even though they said it would follow, it did not follow those patients. And that really stepped up my advocacy, because we were sending people back to our communities who were then becoming homeless, becoming street people, becoming dangerous, becoming difficult to handle in their homes.
Buchanan spent years lobbying on mental health issues. She successfully led an effort to override the governor's veto of funding for Alzheimer's disease centers. More recently, Buchanan has been a vocal advocate for McLean County efforts to boost mental health service. She's spoken to dozens of organizations through her role on the County Board of Health. She says she believes the jail expansion and 24-hour mental health triage could become a model for other communities.
I give them a great deal of credit for the county to step up and take a lead role, putting this out on the horizon and putting it out on the public stage, not saying we're going to do it, we have all the answers, but this is a serious issue and we all have to come together and look at it.
Judy Buchanan has also taken her role as an advocate for the disadvantaged to the Bloomington Normal public transit system, now known as Connect Transit. She plans to leave the board this summer after 11 years with the agency, re-energized and more visible.
When we rebranded and put the buses out there with the blue and the green and started promoting that, a number of people said, oh man, I didn't know we had a bus system.
Buchanan says she has tried to lead by example in every area she has worked.
We have to have the political will, and that's not always easy to come by for a lot of people. But I'm hoping that maybe by stepping out and raising the awareness and helping work toward resolution of problems that people know are out there, that maybe that will encourage others to join that effort.
After a lifetime spent helping the public and the community, Judy Buchanan has now taken on the role of caregiver for her husband, Rich, who has Alzheimer's disease. She's deeply familiar with it. Judy lost her mom to Alzheimer's at a young age and served as the state lobbyist for the Illinois Alzheimer's Association.
I bring perhaps a bit more understanding, but one of the things that strikes me and I get reminded of particularly by my adult children is all the good advice I used to give other caregivers I don't take myself. Take care of yourself, Mom.
Judy says she wasn't surprised by Rich's diagnosis, saying she's noticed his short-term memory loss and erratic decision-making. It wasn't long after that they had the conversation about Rich giving up his seat on the county board.
We talked to him about and shared with him some of the people on the board who I had talked to who were concerned. And we said, this may be the time to retire from public service. You've got that record. You don't want to be retiring when someone puts their hand on your shoulder and says, Rich, it's probably time to go.
Rich retired from political life a second time in 2017.
I would not be able to be proud of my county board service given my abilities and some lack of abilities with this disease. So, no, I'm happy.
And there was the difficult conversation Rich's doctor had about no longer being able to drive.
Rich was about to kind of differ with her a little bit and argue it. And she said, Rich, do you want me to lose my license? What do you mean? She said, if I don't tell you that you can't drive and you drive, I'm going to be held responsible. You know, if you drive and you get lost or you hurt someone. And so she told him at that time, if you drive and I find out about it, I'm going to call the Secretary of State and turn you in.
I understood what she was saying. I could get out and get in the car right now and drive, but I wouldn't be safe.
And that was that. Rich still takes joy in traveling with Judy, supporting her the way she always supported him.
I've always enjoyed everything she's done. And when she would be committed to one of these functions or activities, I felt part of it, and I was expected to support her. And as our kids were growing up, including being a caregiver here at home with the kids, I think we're a match made in heaven.
Another one of McLean County's history makers has lived a life in health care and abroad. Jana Edge, a nurse and health educator, helped lead the first delegation of the Bloomington Normal Sister Cities Partnership with Vladimir, Russia, 30 years ago. It's still going strong today. Edge made more than 20 trips to Vladimir, but it took some cajoling just to get her to make that first voyage. The Bloomington Normal delegation called upon her to respond to Vladimir's request for humanitarian aid as the Russian economy faltered during the Cold War.
I declined because what did I know? I'm a nurse. I can write great care plans. But I had never done any international education, and I'd only been out of the country once.
On the third ask, Edge accepted and helped to round up about $500,000 in medical supplies, many of which were donated by the community.
We had grandmothers who knit sweaters for babies. We had pharmaceutical establishments who gave us medications. We had civic organizations who bought cases of formulas. We had hospitals that allowed us to make purchase with the money that was given to us to buy IV solutions.
She says some of the most appreciated items were mops and buckets with levers to wring them out to clean better. Edge coordinated with a national organization called Physicians for Social Responsibility to ship the supplies to Russia. Edge says these trips were far from vacations, but all well worth it.
I would ask you to give up 2 weeks of your time, pay for your own ticket, work 12 to 14 hours a day, and if you had fun, it was an accident. We did homestays rather than hotels. We did public transportation, but we were given the gift of learning about another culture.
Once in Russia, Edge saw deplorable conditions in many hospitals. She says the Russian government had been woefully underfunding its healthcare system for decades.
You can survive without input for a while, but then things deteriorate greatly. I mean, their hospitals had cement floors. The windows didn't have screens. There may be one restroom on the whole floor of the hospital.
Ed says she sought to make connection with the medical professionals in Russia, and it wasn't always easy to be sensitive in that communication.
There was forbidden words that in America we do it this way. No, we know how America does it. We're going there to learn about how they do it and how can we have common language. And medicine was a good way to do that.
She says it helped in many medical terms have Latin roots, which helped to overcome language barriers. Above all, Edge felt the disjointed Russian healthcare system needed a culture change. Cleaning staff would sometimes transport people through a hospital instead of nurses. She says nurses there were treated as second-class citizens, underpaid and disrespected. She worked to change that.
We did demonstrations. We did side-by-side. So our humanity, I think, came through rather than the stereotypes of the propaganda.
Edge says she wanted to dispel a myth in Russia that all Americans did was count money. She wanted nurses in Russia to understand the nobility of their profession, and they should have the confidence to demand better pay and working conditions.
We said, yes, it's a hard road, but you can do that. The more you learn, the more you learn to communicate, the better you learn to write, the better you learn to negotiate within the system. You can do this for yourself professionally and also for the patient.
Ed says it helped that she had witnessed a transformation in the U.S. in how nurses were treated since she got out of school in the 1950s. She said nurses then were referred to as handmaidens to physicians. Ed says she saw working conditions gradually improve for nurses in Russia in the 3 decades since that first trip to Vladimir. She says she's grateful for the chance to lay a foundation that so many others have built upon, as she borrows from Russian folklore to explain how it all came to be.
It wouldn't have been possible without all of them. But I was the Baba Yaga. I was the one that somebody had to be the leader. Somebody had to make the decision. Somebody had to call the shots. And this community rose above and beyond anything that we could ever dream.
The fourth member of this year's cohort of history makers has also seen conditions improve for him since he was raised as the son of sharecropper parents in Shreveport, Louisiana, during the Great Depression. But Henry Gay says it has not been an easy journey toward racial justice, nor one that is finished. Gay has made improving race relations one of his life goals. Once the youngest member of the Bloomington Normal NAACP, he's now its oldest at 94. Gay remembers life in the segregated South, living out on the farm, knowing it wasn't safe for someone of color to go into the city for something as simple as buying groceries.
We couldn't go to town because they didn't want us there. And whatnot. You can go somewhere else where I don't want you to be. And call you all kind of names. It didn't suit me.
Gay came to Bloomington in 1945. He says conditions weren't much better.
When I first came here, Bloomington now was bad, but just by bad where I come from. Everything, we had outside plumbing. The houses was real bad. You could sit in your living room and count the stars in the roof.
Gay says conditions for many blacks and low-income families didn't start to improve until 1967 when Bloomington passed a Fair Housing Act. He helped push for the measure to force landlords to fix unlivable slum properties. Another turning point in racial relations in Bloomington Normal had come a year earlier, in 1966, when an African-American man named Merlin Kennedy, dressed as Black Santa, atop a float in the Bloomington Normal Christmas Parade. Gay recalls Kennedy's appearance was brief, but made a lasting impact.
You should see the people trying to talk to their kids. Them kids was everywhere. We was only on in about 2 seconds because the police made us take the float out. But Merlin Kennedy still walked with his black suit on.
Police threatened to arrest Old St. Nick. Merlin Kennedy became a McLean County history maker in 2015. While Henry Gay says he doesn't see discrimination ending soon.
Discrimination going to be discrimination for the rest of their life. I said, it was here when I was born. It's going to be here when I'm gone. A lot of people discriminate and don't realize that they discriminate.
While Gay has called out and tried to correct injustices his entire life, he says he's tried to do it in a way that fosters understanding rather than anger.
But you got to be positive. You can't be hot-headed like a lot of people. That's the problem. Nobody respects anybody. See, if people would respect people, one another, the world would be a lot better off place.
Gay says it all goes back to how he was raised, and it was how he and his wife raised 6 children.
Well, in 1966, I was named the meanest dad in Bloomington.
He says you have to be a good citizen, work hard, raise your family, and treat others right.
You got to teach a kid while they're young. That's the problem we got right now. All this stuff going on now, it's just ridiculous because they wasn't raised.
Gay says he's troubled by recent violence in Bloomington Normal. He says mistrust of police only perpetuates violence.
Nobody won't turn them in. How can the police can't be anywhere? I wish people would come out of their shells and tell on these people so to get them off the street because they got fooled around. And a stray bullet don't care who it hit.
Gay insists on personal responsibility, words he says he lives by every day. At age 94, he still works, driving a hearse for a Bloomington funeral home. Gay says he worries the welfare system has made it too easy for some.
Then you got people could be working, but they're not working because you can get stuff too easy. I still say you should wait 2 days, at least 2 days, when you go to these food pantries. Why should you drive up there in a brand new car at a food pantry and you're not working?
For Gay, it's not about the money. He makes that clear when he explains what being named a McLean County History Maker means to him.
I think I'd turn $1 million down for this. That's how much it means. It'd be honor for the whole McLean County. Who wouldn't?
Gay says a sign of racial progress in Bloomington Normal is that the local NAACP has more white members than black. The chapter awards a college scholarship every year in Gay's honor. All of this year's history makers named by the McLean County Museum of History have made their contributions to Bloomington Normal and the way they have lived out their beliefs and passions. I'm Eric Stock.
The History Makers Gala is next week, June 19th, at the Brown Ballroom of Illinois State University's Bone Student Center. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Ryan Denham, and Laura Kennedy. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We'd kind of like to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM. Follow us on Twitter, we're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.